Hysteria is brought to you by Smalls. How are the news and your cats connected?
Well, let's see. The news and my cats, they just keep making a mess. I don't know.
I got to say, the news and my cat are similar because, like, every week or so, I'm like, this can't keep up. This can't keep going on. Like, my cat's 20. I'm like, she's definitely going to die. And then she keeps not dying.
God bless.
She is. I mean, I'm going to be super sad. I probably won't even be able to talk about it. I'll be so sad when she finally kicks the bucket. But I know every week I'm like, the news can't possibly get more chaotic. And then it does. It's like my cat not dying. Is the craziness in the world making you just want to cuddle up on the couch with your cat? My cat doesn't like to cuddle. But if
none of my cats like to cuddle.
If she did. No, she likes to harass my husband. She will not leave him alone. Will not. Like,
so my cats cuddle together. They won't cuddle with me.
I appreciate that, though. That's like,
they do. They like each other.
I feel like my cat knows when I don't want her to be, like, walking on me. Like, if I'm working, she'll come over and be like, don't mind if I rub my face against your computer, like, against the screen, and then step on the keyboard and stuff. So, like, anyway, the craziness in the world, I think, attracts my cat to try to interfere with my spiraling.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, cats are great. You gotta have them. They're like these gross little pals that don't leave you alone. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. If you are a listener of this show, you know my cat has always been fed the best food that money can buy. She's now in the twilight of her life, and so she has a prescription diet. But up until she had her prescription diet, I fed her Smalls. She loved it.
Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'd find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. So I know that when Winky has a sensitive stomach and she prefers Smalls way more than she did her previous food, her tummy handles it better, the taste is better, I like the smell better and the look better, and since making the switch, she's got fewer hairballs. She's got a little more energy, healthier weight, softer fur.
That's great.
Stinky box. That's right. What more can we ask for? Especially when the litter box is outside our bedroom door.
Absolutely. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, like with your kitties.
Yep.
That is a big deal. If you have a particularly picky cat, Smalls has a sampler so your cat can try everything Smalls has to offer. Are they like a cat food flight?
It's a flight. It's a little smorgasbord.
It's a little flight. It goes from the most fine-bodied to the heaviest body. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm imagining it served in, like, little wine glasses. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they will refund you if your cat won't eat their food.
What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time only. Because you're a Hysteria listener, you can get 60% off your first Smalls order plus free shipping by using our code Hysteria. That's 60% off when you head to Smalls.com and use promo code Hysteria. Again, that's promo code Hysteria for 60% off your first order plus free shipping at Smalls.com.
Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I am Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, who would you rather be stuck next to on a 6-hour flight? An eliminated Love Island contestant who just got bumped from first class? Or Ted Cruz coming home from vacation during yet another Texas tragedy, also having been bumped from first class?
I mean, I gotta go with Ted Cruz.
More so
yes!
than the Love Island contestant? Please explain. Show your work, Alyssa.
Okay, let me show you my work. I want to sit next to an agitated, uncomfortable Ted Cruz. I want to record the whole thing. I want the world to see what he's torqued up about when horrible things are happening back in his home state, where he is, like you said, Erin, who needs the National Weather Service when you can just know Ted Cruz is going on vacation, something bad going to happen.
Honestly, you know, Donald Trump and the Doge cuts have, like, impacted National Weather Service and storm forecasting, but I think from now on what we can just do is, like, yeah, if you're at an airport, Ted Cruz is getting on an international flight. Batten down the hatches.
Batten down the hatches.
All right. We had a week off, and all the stuff happened.
So much happened.
All this stuff happened. None of it good. Not. Let's just say that. None of it good.
None of it good.
We don't really get to go into to all of the bad stuff. Today, we are going to talk specifically about the Texas flooding. the tragedy that unfolded in Kerr County, Texas, along the Guadalupe River, and the systemic failures that led to that tragic loss of human life, and how we think it's a total cop-out for people who say don't politicize tragedies.
Wouldn't say that about a plane crash.
I don't buy that. I'm sorry, I don't buy that anymore. Do politicize tragedies. Do politicize them.
Or also don't call getting to the bottom of something politicizing it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Let's rebrand it. Let's call it solving
finding
problems.
Out.
Don't solve problems. Okay. We also have a great interview with journalist TJ Raphael, who came out with a new podcast called Liberty Lost, which is about maternity homes.
Outrageous.
In Things America.
We did not know in the vivid detail were happening that are happening.
Currently. This isn't some like Ken Burns slow pan over sepia-toned.
Today.
It's happening now. So TJ did a great podcast about who it's happening to, how it's happening, and we get into that with her later today. And then we have, I would say, like a bit of a palate cleansing Sani Petty.
Yeah, we run the gambit.
I get to prattle on about Love Island.
I talk about fruit and Hannah Horvath.
All right, stick around. We're going to get into the show. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who know that when they say don't politicize a tragedy, what they mean is we aren't prepared to take any steps to prevent a similar tragedy from happening in the future.
Bingo.
Yep. Don't politicize a tragedy is for people who do not want to take accountability and do not want to change any of their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine a similar approach if, like, let's just say car troubles, right?
Yeah.
Let's say, Alyssa, let's say you keep busting your tires, let's say.
I do, actually.
You just are, well, right. But if your husband was like, Alyssa, let's figure out why your tires keep busting. Is it the brand of the tire? Is it the PSIs? Are they right for your car? And you were like, don't politicize this. I want to keep breaking my tires over and over again. I mean, I don't want to like be trite here, but that's
what I'm
hearing when things happen that represent systemic failures and people don't want to take account of what those systemic failures was.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
correct.
Or were. What those systemic failures were. Systemically, my brain is failing at using language this morning.
It's been a month.
And it's also possible to hold the fact that human tragedy is sad and tragic and devastating. And at the same time, hold in your mind, why did this happen? What can we do to keep this from happening again?
Well, aren't you honoring the people to whom it happened? What if something happened to you? Like, Aaron, let's look at this a very, very, like, I don't know, cynically or empirically. A plane crashes. What on God's planet are we doing if we don't wonder why the plane crashed and hope we figure out why the plane crashed so it doesn't happen again? It is not different.
Right. And if the pilot is the one that crashed the plane on purpose, people can't be like, how dare you? The pilot just died. It's like, yeah, he crashed the plane on purpose. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anyway, so like analogies aside, let's talk about
what
happened this weekend in Texas. Mm-hmm. And what the conversation about what has happened has looked like. Over the weekend, tragic flooding in central Texas took the lives of over 114 people. According to, as of Wednesday, I believe 160 still missing. That number keeps climbing because there's a hotline set up for people to call and report if families are missing. And like not everybody is accounted for. People are still being reported missing.
Well, and also this part of the river where people were is where people go off the grid. So a lot of people don't have their phones. They don't tell people. They go to be alone and be peaceful.
Or like they don't expect to be able to contact, you know, they tell people like, you're not going to be able to talk to me. So at least 27 of the fatalities are counselors and campers from a private summer camp for girls called Camp Mystic. The flood running next to the camp overflowed above the cabins. Even the camp's 74-year-old director, Dick Eastland, died while trying to save the girls at camp. Camp Mystic is kind of an iconic Texas camp. Laura Bush was a counselor there, I've read. It sounds like a lot of camps where, you know, near where I grew up. And I remember going to camp when I was a kid and how happy and fun it was. And it just is like very tragic for something like this to be juxtaposed over like the sort of joy and happiness and freedom that girls experience when they're in an environment like this. Search and rescue crews, along with hundreds of volunteers, are executing one of the largest search operations in Texas history. They're searching through miles of piles of debris and trees and rocks, and they're looking for missing people. I've heard that they haven't found any survivors.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Our hearts go out to everyone hurting after the tragedy. It just is so awful.
Really, it's terrible. Awful. It is. You know, the way that it happened, I think, is the scariest part. In the middle of the night, people asleep in their bunk beds. Some of the people who I think about the most are the, you know, most kids go to camp, and when they're done with camp, they become counselors at the camp. And mm-hmm. a lot of the counselors, you know, are being heralded as heroes. But the trauma that those counselors who survived will go through, knowing all the kids that they couldn't save, is like we're calling them counselors, but I hope that we're going to get them all of the help that they need, because I can't imagine that this is not going to haunt them in one of the most sort of catastrophic circumstances they will probably hopefully ever find themselves in.
Yeah. And yeah, just, I don't know, just it's really awful to think about as a parent.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine.
Anyway, and so amid all of this, there are questions about why. Why mm-hmm. why did this happen? I mean, we know why it happened. The Guadalupe River flooded. It flooded right. in an area known as Flash Flood Alley. It is an area mm-hmm. prone to flash floods. It's difficult to communicate over long distances in this area. It is there is a myriad of just on the ground facts
mm-hmm.
that make it tough, but it gets a little bit more complicated, right?
It does. The flood immediately raised questions about how this was not prevented. Apparently, officials had been aware of the high risk of the flooding for decades. The region where the floods occurred, the Texas Hill Country, is literally referred to as Flash Flood Alley because its topography can funnel and quickly swells rivers. So online, we noticed that people were quick to point fingers, especially at Doge Cuts, before any concrete information had been reported about how the emergency was handled. So we wanted to dive into what really went wrong and how these losses could have been prevented. So one myth we want to bust was that the National Weather Service did not accurately predict the rainfall. According to analysis from independent meteorologists and a former NWS official, the warnings leading up to the floods were as accurate as they could have been expected to be. Flash floods in general are notoriously difficult to predict, and we currently lack the science to accurately predict the precise latitude, longitude, and timing of a specific amount of rainfall. Survivors of the floods reported not receiving any warnings of the flooding or any evacuation notice. This is what can be referred to as the last mile of communication. The National Weather Service did issue warnings that triggered automated alerts to cell phones, but they were likely slept through or missed by many due to spotty cell service. A lot of updates were also issued by the Kerrville Police Department on Facebook. Expecting people to be checking Facebook at 4 a.m. is a mistake in itself. In locations like this, you often need sheriffs and other emergency officials driving around, banging doors, using loudspeakers.
Alyssa, can I break in and tell you mm-hmm. a quick story?
Of course.
So when right after I graduated from high school, there was a tornado in the town north of me
mm-hmm.
called Siren, funny enough. Mm-hmm. But when the tornado was coming in, the siren was not working. There was like this tornado that like had been spotted and it mm-hmm. was on its way to Siren. Siren has like 800 people in it. It's not a big town. So the police chief drove around with like his loudspeaker. He literally did the thing. And it because of it was like in the evening. It wasn't, you know, in the middle of the night or anything like that. Because of it, only a few people died, which is mm-hmm. still like, you know, tragic.
But
you know, it's hard to say how many lives he saved by driving around being like, hey, everybody, there's a tornado coming. You need to get in your basements. And like, that's what local officials are supposed to do. Like if there's like a last mile, if there's any question about whether or not that last mile of communication is going to be effective, local officials need to be out there. That is what they're there for.
It is. And that is actually like one of the coordinating actions of FEMA can be when they know a specific county. Some counties, the churches are folks that have the best way to reach people and know how to reach people. The local sheriffs, police officers, fire departments, like they will send people out. A good example of the last mile working properly was during the Los Angeles fires. When people knew where people were, the firefighters went in and were knocking on doors and trying to get people out and make sure, not just depending on the alerts that they were getting. But according to an op-ed in the Dallas Morning News, Kerr County has river gauges and a cell phone warning system, but they lack a local flash flood warning system. They have repeatedly considered installing one, but abandoned efforts due to costs and lack of funding. The Texas House passed a bill earlier this year that would have created a plan to develop a statewide strategic emergency communication and infrastructure and authorized a grant program to help local governments pay for emergency communication equipment for first responders. However, the bill failed in the Senate.
Oh, wait. Did the representative for Kerr County vote for it?
No, he didn't.
He was one of the reasons that the bill failed.
So, currently, the state is still fully committed to search and rescue efforts, so it has not yet released all the relevant information about what happened during the flood.
Yeah, sorry. That's like you were supposed to read that, but I kept like jumping in being like, like there are so many failures, not of the like weather forecasters, not of the scientists.
Right.
Like the people that
the scientists did their job.
The scientists did their job, and the people who didn't do their job, local officials, local officials, local and state government. I read that that Governor Abbott received like a grant from the Biden administration as part of the Build Back Better plan. There was some sort of something in the Build Back Better plan that gave the state money for like weather preparedness, infrastructure stuff. And Greg Abbott just like didn't use it because it was from Joe Biden.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Wait. Wow. Way to punk the libs.
Yeah. You sure owned the libs. You owned the libs. And now there's like, you know, a bunch of little girls died. Great job. A bunch of little girls drowned, Governor Abbott. Did you see that? I'm sorry. Like, I think in moments like this, it's like, I think that a natural human response is like, who can I get mad at? You know?
Right.
And like, just getting mad at somebody is not really useful unless it's like, who can I get mad at and what needs to happen in order for this to not happen? There needs to be like a tag on to that. But like, Greg Abbott, absolute fucking failure of a governor, failure of a human being.
The power grid was down for how many days since he's been governor? I mean, he is a wreck.
The bitch cannot govern.
The bitch can't govern. We've said it since the beginning.
Every time he is faced with any kind of tragedy or challenge in his state, he responds in the weirdest, most pugnacious, and like unfeeling way possible. Did you see that press conference he gave?
Of course I did.
When he referred to what like reflection and reflection on like the causes of tragedy as loser behavior, right? Yes. Is that what loser behavior
is? Well, and the thing about him is he's had his ass covered for the past 12 years, however the fuck long he's been governor. Because when things happened under Trump, Trump came and covered up, made sure he was good, got everything he needed. Biden, acting like a proper president, didn't punish states that didn't vote for him. So he got help then too. And now with Trump as president, you know, they'll try to make sure that all of the investigations come out that he didn't do anything wrong.
But here's the thing, like, I don't know that that's a priority for Trump right now. Like sucking up to Greg Abbott. Like, what's a priority for Trump is photo, like as literally as like the cleanup is happening. I've heard that FEMA, as of Tuesday night, I'm not sure, as of Wednesday morning, FEMA's not even there yet, right? Like, FEMA's not even there yet helping.
This is the whole thing about the Doge cuts. They were made so haphazardly. They weren't made strategically. They didn't actually go into FEMA and say, well, this is redundancy with another agency, so you don't need this. They just cut heads and money with no understanding of why. So typically, Aaron, at this point of a tragedy like this, a natural disaster, FEMA would be on the ground doing two things. They would be getting people information. They would be helping them fill out forms so that they can get money and they can get help. And there would be something called Operation Clean Sweep happening, which is trying to clean up the debris, which both helps find people who are still missing and also helps people to get on with their lives. Near as we can tell, neither of those things are happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what is happening. You know, the Trump administration is still staging photo ops in Los Angeles with immigration raves. Like, they're riding horses onto soccer pitches in MacArthur Park in order to appear like badass. I think there is, if you are a human being whose soul and brain isn't irreparably broken, you can look at that juxtaposition and think, you know, Donald Trump doesn't care about human tragedy. He does not care about these little girls, their families, the people who are just like in the area camping, the people who were swept away in the floodwaters. He does not care. Does not care about you. Doesn't care about your family. Doesn't care about your grief. He's made some like, you know, some like empathy kabuki moves during his like cabinet meeting where he talked about Texas being a tragedy. But like, talk's cheap, man. Talk is like really fucking cheap.
But you know, he could have, and like, Aaron, you know that I like worked for a president who did the hard tragedy. And right now, the flood happened 2 days ago. Right now, in terms of like Sandy Hook, Barack Obama was there at the funeral. Meeting with every single family, every single child, sibling that survived in Newtown. And it fucked him up. Because sometimes you have to do the hard shit that fucks you up. And what Donald Trump could have at least done the story that gave me nightmares last night, but it's just two, it's the two sisters that were found holding hands. Like, if Donald Trump can't even, in a moment of empathy, reference what those parents must be going through. Like how they survive. You know, they send their kids to the best camp that they know of, and now their girls aren't coming home, and he can't even
he's not there. Has he gone there? Has he gone to Texas?
No, no. Now, I will say this.
It's 5 days later.
It is 5 days later. It is such a mess. He is not a helpful presence right now. In that area, he could go to Austin, appearing
alongside Governor Abbott in a press conference. He could be going somewhere that is like drawing attention to, like, if he believes that Texas needs help. And you know, I'm gonna say Texas needs our sympathies, our empathy, our hearts to be with the victims. Texas also needs to examine what happened to enable this tragedy to unfold. And like, he can be there and accomplish, I mean, the president alleged, you know, he's got a ton of support in the state of Texas. He could accomplish two things. He could bring attention among like local and state officials like, hey guys, guess what? I know you thought it was going to cost too much money. Look what happened. We got to figure out a way to prevent this from happening again. He could be there to like get the ball rolling on the policy solutions that need to be proposed, right?
Right.
He could also get the ball rolling on like, these fucking local officials in Kerr County are just looking at them in press conferences makes me want to punch my screen. Eyes darting back and forth. All they want to do is like get, you know, not be blamed for what happened. You posted on Facebook, motherfucker. You posted on Facebook. You thought you could post your way out of an emergency? Like, fuck you, dude. You didn't do enough. You didn't do enough to such a degree that like, dozens and dozens of people were dead. What were you doing? Were you like drunk and passed out because it was the 4th of July? Like, were you lighting off fireworks? Like, what were you doing? This is what you were supposed to be doing and you didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, honestly, Governor, it's not going to happen because these are like his homeboys. I think they all look like homeboys of Governor Abbott. All the like local officials that are like, you know, gurgling excuses for themselves. They need to be held accountable for the mistakes that they've, for the horrible mistakes that they've made to set an example. I'm sorry, you can't just, Texas officials anywhere, law enforcement officials anywhere, you cannot just sit there and post on Facebook or stand in the hallway or like when children's lives are in danger. You can't just fucking stand there and then like continue on your way. You don't get to continue being a law enforcement official. You fucked up that bad. Like, that's how bad you fucked up.
And when they're sitting there filling the big bad bill with all the pork that they have for some of the dumbest shit that we've ever seen and cutting some of the most important funding that we need. You know, one of the things they could have done, Aaron, they could have found one of the issues was that there was no cell service in a lot of these areas. Do you know how rampant that problem is across the country? Mm-hmm. Do you know that a woman in upstate New York was shot to death because she was in the middle of a heart attack and 911 on her phone wasn't working and she pulled down a driveway to try to get someone to call for help for her and they thought she was a trespasser? So it's happening across the country and it seems like that's an investment that could help everybody, but why would we talk about that?
Yeah. And also, you know, this is something I've also read is that Texas government kind of abuses those push alerts on people's phones.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they get an alert on their phone every time a police officer is in trouble. And like, why do people need to get a push? So, right. Yeah. This is something that I actually, yeah, I heard this on Slate's What Next podcast. There was a Texan who was talking about like what contributed to the tragedy. And he said that they get something called a blue alert. And so a lot of people just like turn their phone off because they're like, I don't want to know about some random like police officer in a different city. Like at 3 a.m, I don't want that to I don't want that to wake me up. So people who do have cell phone service, a lot of times, like I turn off my emergency alerts. Like I turn them back on after the fires. But like I turn off my emergency alerts like if I feel like I'm getting too many of them. It's like annoying. And I think that like governments should be cognizant of how many alerts they're sending to citizens so that people actually pay attention.
You know what you'll always pay attention to? The once or twice a year, if you're like me and you still have a television, and they test the emergency broadcast system, they never abuse it, but you sit there and you read that scroll across the bottom, and we do get it up here. We get tornado warnings. And if that alert goes off on the television, it's stop, drop, and roll. You know, like you just stop and you pay attention to it. So it's like they just...
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's something about human nature, too, that like people don't want to spend money on something that is going to prevent a tragedy that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
They want to throw money after tragedies rather than like, you know, put down some money before tragedies. And like, it's really frustrating to see it over and over again. People not willing to be like, hey, what's something that we can do to, you know, to like shore up, like this could happen.
Well, and here's the big thing too, Aaron, is that this specific area where these camps are has flooded catastrophically like 4 times in the past 100 years. Right. And with climate change getting worse and worse, and we know these storms are getting more violent, more immediate, more extreme, like how can one and one not equal two? You know, like it will, if it is going to happen, it will happen here.
Yeah.
And everything that's happening is more extreme and more awful. So why are we fucking ignoring it? By the way, they are talking about riverbanks that are inhabited by camps of children.
Yeah. It also feels like something that I've kind of been saying and thinking a lot lately about how like American optimism is kind of like really awful and poisonous and like optimism that leads you to be complacent. Like the belief that you can just do nothing and everything will turn out okay. Or that like, you know, the belief that like you don't have to take any steps to save yourself, that everything is just going to like turn out and the worst thing isn't going to happen. Like it just seems very like uniquely, I mean, I think it's human nature, but I also think it's like uniquely part of our American nature to just be like, well, it'll probably be okay. Right? Like, it's probably going to be okay, right? Like, maybe I just won't pay attention. I won't do anything, and it's probably going to be fine.
Well, look, Aaron, it's like because we have all this technology, how could things not ultimately be okay? But the one thing I did want to say, and you know I'm like a broken record, and you and I have talked about this a lot, but for everybody listening, always make sure you either have a battery-operated radio, a ham radio, or a hand crank radio, because NOAA will operate off of AM radio. Like, it's just, in an emergency, it is a great thing to have, especially in places that have really spotty coverage.
And I'm going to also add, and I've said this before on the podcast, but if you have a kid with a lot of energy, giving them a hand crank radio during like a disaster is a really good way for it to occupy them, keep them in one place, and like burn off some of that energy.
Get it going. You're helping mommy.
I wanted to talk briefly before we take a break about
the way that information was spread and shared and the way that people jumped to conclusions right after this happened. And I think, like, you know, after, you know, digesting and discussing the human tragedy of it, let's take a step back and be like, how are we contributing to an information environment that makes it more difficult to get to the truth? And I think, you know, we can take a look at how many people, especially on social media, where there is no fact-checking, there's no rigor to be like, hey, you know, actually, let's figure out what the case, let's not jump to conclusions. We saw a lot of people jumping to conclusions, including local officials being like, local officials taking advantage of people jumping to conclusions. People jumping to conclusions saying like, oh, this is Doge. The weather forecasters didn't do their job. The warnings didn't come down in time because Doge, the cuts from Doge are really bad, obviously. And there will be a situation at some point where we can directly trace a tragedy to something that got cut that shouldn't have gotten cut. But this was not one of those cases. And I feel like a lot of the people that I saw blame being like, well, this is what you voted for. Like, this is what Trump did. We're sort of like obscuring the fact that like this was a local official fuck up. This was a local.
Right. It lets people off the hook. It makes Greg Abbott not have to answer the hard questions.
Greg Abbott, local officials, state officials, people who just like taxpayers themselves who are like unwilling to shell out to take steps to prevent tragedies, to alert people of like natural disasters. Like, I think like it's not helpful to be like, well, this is what happens when you vote to like cut NOAA. It's like,
right. Well, and there's a question too that a such a well-funded camp wouldn't have had some sort of alert system.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You know, not blaming the victims, but you, they were on a river. It's surprising to me that the camp itself wouldn't have had some sort of alert system, or maybe it didn't. It failed. I don't know. But also a question worth asking.
Yeah, it just seems like there was a lot of things that happened that, you know, led to the natural disaster of it all. You know, is like getting worse because of climate change. These are going to happen more often because of climate change. The weather in Texas is going to keep getting worse because of climate change. And it's frustrating to watch in the aftermath people being like, please don't tell us the causes or any solutions.
Right, because these are the people who, like, the chickens are coming home to roost, right? Either you have to accept climate change and try to mitigate for climate change, or you have to start doing the infrastructure work and investment in communities where you're like, well, we're just going to let it rip. Well, in communities like that, you need better alert systems.
You need to acknowledge reality is the thing. Like, I think that there are a lot of people in, like, you know, like a Greg Abbott type or like a person who is like a deep red state voter can completely customize reality to an extent for themselves. They can immerse themselves in the fake reality of Fox News. They can spend all day watching Fox. Like, in their reality, there are riots in the streets of LA and like trans athletes are terrorizing girls coast to coast. They can pretend that that's reality. They can live inside of that pretend. They can pretend that they're, you know, they can pretend all kinds of things. They can surround themselves with like-minded people and pretend that this is how everybody thinks. But you can't pretend away God. You can't and by God, I mean like the wrath of God. I mean like the force of God. I mean like the force of nature. You cannot pretend away the reality of a natural disaster. You cannot pretend that climate change is not making things worse because there are consequences to that. Right. The consequences are tragedies like this. And like the flood still would have happened, right?
Flood still would have happened. But with a little bit more warning, think of how many lives could have been saved.
Yeah. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're interviewing the journalist behind one of the most engrossing podcasts that I've listened to in years. It is so good. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hysteria is brought to you by Hiya. Typical children's vitamins are basically candy in disguise. I mean, Alyssa, do you know anybody, or possibly did you ever abscond with your like other your kids' vitamins when you were little and like eat them like candy because they were like candy?
Yeah, I mean, they were candy.
I did one time and I got in trouble. And I had a tummy ache as a result.
I'm sure you did. That's a lot of vitamin D. Yeah, and sugar.
That's a lot of sugar. Well, Hiya was created to not be that. Hiya has created a super-powered, chewable vitamin for kids. While many children's vitamins are filled with a bunch of sugar and, you know, other yucky stuff you don't want your kids to have, Hiya is made with zero sugar and zero gummy additives. It tastes great. It's perfect for picky eaters. My daughter, right now, she's extended her, like, food taste.
She's branching out.
She ate a taco pocket, which was basically like a little empanada, basically. Yeah. She ate an empanada the other day, and we were like, oh, yes, you ate an empanada. But she also loves her Hiya vitamins. Like, she loves very few things, and she loves taking her Hiya vitamin. They come in like pink, green, and yellow, and she calls the green ones her Alphaba vitamins because she likes Alphaba, the character from Wicked. It's pretty cute. Hiya fills in the most common gaps in modern children's diets to provide the full body nourishment our kids need with a yummy taste they love. Formulated with the help of pediatricians and nutritional experts, Hiya is pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies and then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others to help support immune system, energy, brain function, mood, concentration, teeth, bones, and more.
It's non-GMO, vegan, dairy-free, allergy-free, gelatin-free, nut-free, and everything else you can imagine. Every single batch is third-party tested for heavy metals and microbials in a qualified GMP-compliant lab using scientifically validated testing methods, so you know the product is safe and nutritious. Hiya is designed for kids 2 and up and sent straight to your door, so parents have one less thing to worry about. Are you tired of battling with your kids to eat their greens? Hiya now has Kids Daily Greens Plus Superfoods, a chocolate-flavored greens powder designed specifically for kids, packed with more than 55 whole food ingredients to support brain power, development, and digestion. Just scoop, shake, and sip with milk or any non-dairy beverage for a delicious and nutritious boost your kids will actually enjoy. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to HiyaHealth.com. /hysteria. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to HiyaHealth.com/hysteria and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that's about to interview a podcaster about her new podcast, otherwise known as a Matryoshka or Russian nesting pod. Do you have one of those, Alyssa?
Do you have
a nesting doll?
I do. Got it from Russia.
I got one for my kid. I thought it would be a cute gift. It's not. It's many pieces that get lost. All right. Let's get into this interview because I'm so excited to talk about what we're going to talk about today. Today, we have the talented producer, journalist, and host, TJ Raphael, here to discuss her new investigative podcast, Liberty Lost, a heart-wrenching investigation into the dystopian maternity home run out of Liberty University. TJ, welcome back to Hysteria.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, before we get into it, oh my God.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That.
Okay, a little under the hood. When TJ pitched us on this podcast, I was like, what? This sounds crazy. And then when we were able to listen to the podcast, I spent the entire time listening with my jaw dropped. Like from second one. So like, bravo, TJ. This is an amazing podcast.
TJ, I had to drive in my car listening to it because I didn't want to be distracted. And I had to keep pulling over and like taking notes that I couldn't, things that I couldn't believe. Like that can't be possible. And then I'd get back in the car, rewind 20 minutes and listen again. I'm like, no, it did happen. it was really extraordinarily done.
Thank you.
And could you give us a TLDR about what the show Liberty Lost is about for listeners?
So Liberty Lost focuses in on the Liberty Godparent Home, which was opened in 1982 by controversial preacher Reverend Jerry Falwell, the architect of the Moral Majority, one of, you know, the founders of the modern evangelical right. And Falwell opened this maternity home in response to Roe v. Wade. He thought that if he could show America, if he could show the courts, that there could be a quote-unquote alternative to abortion, that, you know, eventually Roe v. Wade, there would be the political will to do away with it. So Falwell opens this home. He uses his television show, The Old Time Gospel Hour, to basically source his own followers to send their pregnant teenage daughters to this maternity home. And so this maternity home is still operational. It's on the campus of Liberty University. And I was able to connect with multiple women who went through the home as pregnant teenage girls. And yeah, their stories are heart-wrenching. They describe an environment of coercion, pressure, religious manipulation, until they surrendered their babies for adoption to affluent Christian couples, often in exchange for scholarships to Liberty University.
Okay, TJ, before your podcast, there was virtually no coverage of this idea of the godparent home outside of the narrative that Liberty University promotes through its own channels. So how did you first come across the story?
Yeah, so it was in the summer of 2022, and I was interested in doing something related to abortion rights. Eventually, I made the podcast The Pill Plot, which right. I came on here to talk about. But I also, at that time, heard from a woman named Abby Johnson. Okay. I had put out a call, and I said, you know, I want to speak with women who went through maternity homes, because I felt like the pre-Roe era was one, of course, of, you know, dangerous back alley abortions. But that was just one part of the story of the pre-Roe era. It was also a time of forced birth mm-hmm. and coerced adoption and maternity homes. So yeah, I put out this call in social media. I expected to hear from mainly from baby boomers, women in their, you know, 60s and 70s. And I did get a lot of emails from them. But I also got an email from Abby Johnson. And when she reached out to me in 2022, she was 31 years old.
Yeah.
And she told me that she had been at this maternity home in 2008. I mean, that's the same year Beyonce and Jay-Z got married, same year President Obama was elected. Like, it wasn't long ago. And when she told me that this maternity home was on the campus of Liberty University and, you know, started by Jerry Falwell, I mean, alarm bells started mm-hmm. to go off. And that's what really set me down the path of looking into this. And like you said, Alyssa, there really hasn't been any coverage of this place in the decades since it's been open. I think a lot of the reason for that is, as you can hear from the women in our series, the experiences of being there are incredibly painful, mm-hmm. whether or not you placed your child for adoption. One woman, you know, she wound up keeping her daughter, right. but remains traumatized from her time there.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, I've got two little kids, and I also am friends with a woman who is like a birth mother. Like, she gave mm-hmm. up. She has now. She's like. Had her own kid that she kept, and she's also been a birth mother. And the trauma of like being a birth mother is really profound. And like the thing that really stuck out to me the most was like the heartbreak of the mothers whose babies were basically coerced away from them, even like later. There's one woman that you speak to who seemed like at the time she felt pretty solidly that she wanted to mm-hmm. to surrender her baby for adoption. But she even sounded traumatized and fully like at the time believed that like wealthy and pious people were more worthy of having her baby than she was as the mother. That, and I feel like the Liberty home or the Liberty Godparent home kind of hammered that message into the girls who were there, that rich Christian couples actually deserve to have children more than mm-hmm. poor people or young women who aren't married. Like, if Liberty University actually cared about the lives of babies, like, why wouldn't they promise to just give the moms money after the baby's born?
Right.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, I think it, you know, relates back to Jerry Falwell's ideals of traditional family values, quote unquote. You know, our main source for the show, Abby Johnson, she kind of explained it perfectly to me. She said that, you know, in a Christian's mind in that environment, you know, the baby is thought of as pure and sinless. And the mother who got pregnant out of wedlock is thought of as sinful and scandalous. Mm-hmm. So in a Christian's mind, you know, keeping that baby, that, you know, pure baby with the sinful mother equates in a Christian's mind to celebrating sinful behavior. So they want to get those babies, pure babies, and match them up with, you know, pure married couples, pure quote unquote. And so that's really the motivation. It's a very patriarchal attitude, you know, very heteronormative, that says a child should only grow up in the context of marriage, that single moms, you know, shouldn't be seeking any resources, whether that's, you know, Medicaid or food stamps or things like that, that is bad for society. And the only, you know, way to really have a family is to do it through a married couple. And also, I mean, for Falwell, he, you know, said that, you know, these children would be then raised up in, you know, his church among his ideals. He's kind of creating a new generation of Christians, basically.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but underneath the piety, there's also like a lot of money, right?
Right.
Like, and I feel like they're, you capture this really well in the podcast, is like, they talk about how like all these ideals and building a nation of like, you know, a white Christo fascist nation, whatever. But ultimately, like every single baby that gets adopted from the godparent maternity home, that's like tens of thousands of dollars or $100,000 to the agency that like, I mean, it literally sounds like Liberty University is like a child trafficking organization. Did you ever get to a point where you felt like that in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that it was incredibly alarming. You know, the adoption fees at Family Life Services, which is the godparent home, are the godparent home's adoption agency, it's physically attached to the maternity home. So a lot of the women I spoke to said it was kind of like living inside of an adoption agency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their fees start at, you know, $30,000. And that's just the starting fee. You know, it can go up from there. And then Falwell himself was using these pregnant teenage girls to raise money constantly. Yeah. Like, his television show would do hour-long specials on the godparent home.
And he would trot them out, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He would ask them to stand up. He would bring them to the front of the church and, you know, then ask people to open their wallets. You know, there's a clip that we play in the show, though, where he says, make your check payable to the old-time gospel hour. So the checks weren't even being made out to the godparent home. And yet, you know, the women in the home, many of them were signed up for Medicaid. I was able to get my hands on multiple copies of the home's official handbook. It says very clearly that they pay for none of the girls' medical services. I mean, they also had to, you know, their parents were paying for their maternity clothes, mm-hmm. for their toiletries, for, you know, everything. Their, you know, the furniture at the home was donated. So yeah, I mean, it's very unclear, you know, Falwell's using these pregnant teenage girls to raise money. And yet it doesn't seem that that money is actually going to help these girls. And, you know, the staffers I spoke to, they said that they were, you know, making minimum wage working there. So it's not like the people inside were really getting paid a lot. It's kind of just being funneled into the Liberty University system, it seems.
TJ, were you ever able to see inside the home or see pictures of it?
Yes. So I was able to find a video on YouTube where they did like a virtual tour, and I showed that to multiple of my sources and I said, does this look the same? And they said, yes, for the most part, it looks the same. Maybe the paint has changed over the years, but it, you know, that was it. And it's a fairly modest, you know, colonial brick building. If you didn't know what it was, you would have no idea at all. And I actually did go to Lynchburg, Virginia, and drove outside the godparent home. Wow. They were having an annual gathering of birth mothers. I asked if I could go and they told me no, but I still decided to drive by and see the place for myself. So yeah.
Well, one of the things that I just couldn't get over, I mean, just how every part of the system failed these women. But when Deanne, the social worker, whose only job is to make sure that Abby is not being coerced.
Yeah.
Actually coerces her.
Yeah. It was very upsetting. I mean
you can, that is that woman's job, like the job of social worker. It was like such a deeply corrupt. I think that's the thing that you walk away with, like how deeply corrupted all of these people were in the name of God or Jerry Falwell, and how, you know, the part that I really had to like take a moment was that they tell all of these girls, you do this, you do this, you do God's will, you give the baby, and God forgives you, right? And that wasn't true for any of them in the real world. None of them went back into society as if they had done a wonderful thing and that they had been forgiven, especially the fight between Abby and her father, which was, he didn't. He called her a slut, you know, like nothing right. had been forgiven. And so at that point, it's like, well, what have I done all of this for, if not your forgiveness? If you haven't forgiven me, then God hasn't forgiven me. And I just, that part was really, I felt like that was really emotive.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a punishment. Mm-hmm. You've had sex outside of marriage, you know, you're a heathen, you're scandalous, and your punishment is having your child permanently separated from you mm-hmm. and living with the pain. You know, some of the women described it to me, like, you know, the idea that your living child is out there and you don't have access to them, that's one of the most painful things for them. And yeah, I mean, as it relates to Deanne, the caseworker, mm-hmm. you know, she has since become the director of the adoption agency that still exists.
Deranged.
Yeah, she's running the whole place. I mean, I saw on their Instagram last year alone, they did, I think, 5 or 6 adoptions. So their business is still booming. And that's infant adoptions. I mean, in the United States, you know, there are up to 45 families waiting for every one available right. infant. So even one agency doing 5 adoptions, to me, that seems like a pretty high number. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, heard from other sources that in, you know, Virginia Baptist Hospital there, they're handing out pamphlets of Family Life Services wow. to pregnant women there. So, you know, it's incredibly alarming. And yeah, I asked the Department of Social Services if they plan to open an investigation, and they
yeah.
just sent me an online complaint form. So, yeah.
Complaint filed.
I mean, the thing, here's something that sticks out to me. Like, even with all of that coercion and all of that money behind it and all of those like all the lying, all the sliminess, all of the like bullying, there's the other side of that is there's still only 5 or 6 a year. It's really, women don't want to give up their babies. Like, mothers do not want to give up their babies. And I think that's like an inconvenient truth that
yeah.
the godparent home like it tries to kind of pretend doesn't exist. Like, they really don't want to get, we don't, like, mothers don't want to give up their babies. They don't want to.
Right. I mean, when Abby was a resident, you know, one of the staffers that I spoke to, she said about half of the residents at that time were placing their children, which is still extraordinarily high when considering, you know, the national average has been about 1% nationwide for the last 20 years. 1% of people who get pregnant will wind up placing their children for adoption. So 50% is like a 5,000%
right.
increase. And I know that other maternity homes, you know, as part of my research, I dove into the archives of Heartbeat International's podcast. Heartbeat International is, you know, one of the world's largest anti-abortion organizations. They have a quote-unquote pregnancy help podcast. And they were talking about this brand new maternity home that is open in Utah. It opened within the last 2 years. And this maternity home is reporting a 45% yeah. adoption rate. So again, like, that is 4,500% higher than the national average. And I think when you, mm-hmm. you know, have vulnerable pregnant women living in a facility that holds a certain viewpoint and worldview about who is a fit and appropriate parent, that just snowballs into pressure.
Mm-hmm. What's the current status of the Liberty Godparent Home? Like, you said that they had like a gathering and there's people still living there. Like, how many people are there right now? Like, how much money is it generating, et cetera?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how many residents they have there. I know that in early January of this year, Jonathan Falwell, son of Jerry Falwell, presented the Godparent Home with a $20,000 check. I know that they're doing renovations. I know that they've gotten a bunch of new beds and furniture donated, but I don't know how many residents are there because they refused to talk to me. I reached out to them multiple times over the course of a year. Through every means available, I called, I texted, you know, people, staffers, I emailed, I added people on LinkedIn and Facebook, or at least tried to. I sent letters via snail mail. And unfortunately, to date, I've never gotten a response. So, you know, there's no, I don't have any information about how many residents are there, but they are currently operational and are gearing up, it seems, with this new renovation to bring in more women who might be in search of help and, you know, winding up there instead.
Yeah, I just found the Instagram.
Oh, no.
I had to look.
Oh, my gosh. Alyssa showed me Caroline, was it you? I think Caroline found a video from the Liberty Godparent Home from their channel. And it's one of the creepiest videos I've ever seen. And I was, like, only able to watch a couple minutes of it before I had to turn it off. It was, like, a silent, pregnant teen sitting next to her dad whose, like, hand was on her knee. And, like, talking about, yeah, it was so, like, in the podcast, you talk about how they're taking in foster teens now? Like, what can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. So around 2012, they got licensed with the state as a children's residential facility. And that meant that they were able to take in pregnant girls and young women from the foster care system or through the court system. And so basically what was happening around that time is they saw that, you know, the white Christian, you know, middle-class families that were kind of their bread and butter for years, they weren't sending their daughters to maternity homes as much. Also, I mean, pregnancy rates nationwide had started going down around that time. And so in order to stay open, you need to bring bodies through the door. And so they got licensed with the state as this children's residential facility. They did let that license expire in 2023. So they no longer can take in pregnant residents from foster care or through the court system. However, they can renew that license because they're were in good standing when they let it lapse. And I think part of the reason they let it lapse is because they're doing this renovation of the home right now. And so, yeah, I mean, even if it's not licensed, like in the state of Virginia, I've looked into this, like because it's a religiously affiliated institution, it doesn't need a license to operate. It just can't like get like government, you know, designees to go there and like, you know, send children there basically. But yeah, I mean, when it was operational and taking or operational to take girls from the foster care system, you know, I spoke to this CPS investigator, Evan Cater. He was in the U.S. Air Force. He was a big supporter of both Liberty and the Godparent Home. And when he was on the job as a CPS investigator, he came in contact with the facility and saw that they were kicking, you know, pregnant girls out if they didn't want to do an adoption. And he had to take a pregnant teenager and place her in the foster care system because the Liberty Godparent Home had turned her onto the street after she said she would not place her child for adoption. So it's, yeah, incredibly alarming and upsetting. But yeah, I'm very grateful to the women in this series that have agreed to speak, you know, some of them for the first time. And since the series aired, I've been hearing from people who have gone through the this maternity home at different time periods. I have an interview scheduled next week. I heard from a former staffer who told me that when she was working there, Jerry Falwell was still alive. This was in like 2001 or 2002. And that Falwell himself was reviewing the notes from the girls' counseling sessions. That's how involved he was.
That's so creepy.
That is so creepy.
Oh, what a creep.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, in a statement to Glamour magazine, Liberty University said, quote, claims of this tabloid podcast disguised as irresponsible journalism designed to undermine this important work and to minimize the importance and effectiveness of pro-life organizations. I don't even know what that says. What is your response to Liberty University basically poo-pooing the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of issued a blanket statement trying to refute, you know, the work of the podcast. I'm not surprised by that. I don't think the podcast makes them look very good. However, you know, I would have loved to talk to them. Like, as I mentioned earlier, like, I had reached out so many times asking them to participate. I even presented with them the very specific claims that people were saying of like, we are going to publish this statement that somebody said, would you like to respond to this? So that they knew everything that was in the podcast that was said about them, that they could then take the opportunity to refute. They could, you know, take the opportunity to challenge it. they didn't take that opportunity at all. And the idea that this is threatening, you know, quote unquote, pro-life work is, to me, kind of funny, because all of the women featured in this series had already decided against abortion. You know, they wanted to keep and parent their children. Only one of them had considered abortion at all, and that was very brief. And then she made the decision not to do it, and she wanted to keep her baby. So to me, you know, the mission of the home seems to be, you know, we're saving babies from abortion. But all the women I spoke to wanted to have their babies and, you know, parent them. So it seems kind of counterintuitive to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep TJ around because we've got more questions and we've got more to talk about. Hysteria is brought to you by Aura Frames. I don't know about your family, Alyssa, but like we have a cluster of birthdays in my family that happen over the summer. Like there's so many Geminis, Cancers, and Leos, man. And
our quagmire is February and March.
Interesting.
Back to backs.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. My husband's family is like all in December. Him and his brother and sister, they all have birthdays in the same week, and it's right around Christmas. It's like a,
That's tough.
Yeah, it is really tough. But you know what? Even if you have a cluster of birthdays and you're like, what do I get? Here's a good idea for a gift. Aura Frames.
Perfect.
It is perfect for sharing pics of all the things that relatives who might live somewhere else can't necessarily be there for, like family vacations to their grandkids, elementary school, graduation.
So you know what was great for us, Erin? My family, we don't have a lot of photo sharing. I would not say that we are a great photo sharing family, but you can set it up for your parents, grandparents as they would be. It's the gift that keeps on giving because they just get new pics. Every now and again, they get a nice little pic of the new grandkid. They don't care about seeing me anymore. Just cats and babies. Cats and babies. And it's like, here you go. Enjoy yourself. It is the most hassle-free, joyful thing that you can provide.
You know, I don't know if your mom is like this, but my mom does this. If I don't like send her enough pictures or if I don't contact her enough, I'll get like maybe like 2-3 days. I'll get a text that's just like, are you okay? And I feel like Everything all right? I haven't heard from you. And I feel like an Aura frame would help stave that off because I always get the are you okay text when I'm like recording or like I'm driving. And it's like, how are you? It's like, oh, yeah, I wish that there was just a way. And not like I don't like communicating with my mom, but like it's funny. She has like a sixth sense and she can tell when I'm busy and she texts me then and acts concerned. And I feel like an Aura frame is a good way for me to like send her pictures and be
totally,
like, just proof of life, mom.
Upload them.
I'm
so
fine.
Nice.
I'm fine. Everything is okay. Aura frames come with unlimited storage and simple controls on the frame so you can upload as many photos as you want and mom can pick the perfect one. See why it was named the number one digital frame by Wirecutter, The Strategist, and Wired. You can save on the perfect gift that keeps on giving by visiting AuraFrames.com. For a limited time, listeners can get $20 off their best-selling Carver Matt frame with the code AURA20. That's AURA frames.com, promo code AURA20. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. All right, welcome back to Hysteria, and we're still here talking to TJ Raphael about her new podcast, Liberty Lost. TJ, you talk about the era that you this current era is Baby Scoop 2.0. Can you talk about Baby Scoop 1.0? When did that take place and how is this different?
Yeah, so from basically the period that after World War II, sort of 1945, to the early 1970s when Roe happened, maternity homes were all over the United States and all over the world. You know, some listeners might be familiar with like the Magdalen Laundries in Ireland. This was a period of time in the West that it was incredibly shameful for women to have sex outside of marriage, to be pregnant, to be single mothers. I mean, it was also very impractical at that time. You know, women weren't allowed to have credit cards. Most of them were not allowed, you know, to go pursue higher education. And in society, if you were a woman without a husband, you were viewed a certain way. And then basically by the 1970s, all that started to change. As divorce became more socially acceptable, the stigma around single motherhood began to shrink. Of course, it's not even today completely gone, the stigma around single motherhood. But it began to shrink where women didn't feel the need to have to go hide their pregnancies and place their children for adoption. And so during this time of the baby scoop era, there were 1.5 million adoptions, non-familial adoptions, but when taking into account familial adoptions, so maybe, a daughter gets pregnant and her aunt adopts the baby or a cousin or something like that, actually the number's closer to 4 million.
Wow.
And so millions of children were transferred from single women to married couples, and it was sort of the boom years of adoption. But yeah, as divorce became more socially acceptable, as the women's rights movement took off, as the pill was introduced, and other forms of birth control became widely accessible, as well as abortion became legalized, maternity homes around the country started to shrink, and the supply of infants in the United States also shrank with it. And so, yeah, I mean, one thing that's really interesting to me that we didn't get to cover in the podcast, but I think is important to note, is that I think adoption and abortion are more intimately linked than we realize. Like, you know, Norma McCorvey, the woman who had become known and made famous by the pseudonym Jane Roe, we don't often talk about the fact that she was a birth mother. She had lost two children to adoption, and then she became pregnant again and wanted to end the pregnancy, and that's when she goes on the journey, which eventually leads her to becoming Jane Roe. But she had said that, you know, one of her life's greatest sorrows were those adoptions. And she said, I had been pregnant 3 times, but I was never allowed to be a mother. And, you know, that kind of gives me chills. And, Norma, I think, you know, obviously her legacy, I think, is quite complicated. But I think we don't acknowledge the fact that, like, adoption is so challenging for so many women, even if you voluntarily enter into it. And it's kind of a reproductive justice issue that I think is often left out of the conversation around choice. And I hope that, you know, this series, yeah, helps people think more deeply about what it means to have a right to choose and what choice really looks like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that Liberty Godparent Home is not the only maternity home in the U.S. In our last segment, you alluded to a new maternity home in Utah. Like, how many maternity homes are we talking here in the year of our Lord 2025? Like, how many are there? Where are they? Like, who's running them?
Yeah, so there are currently 500 maternity homes around the country. They're in 48 states. So there might be one in the state that you live in. Government funding has helped fuel the expansion. States since the end of Roe have funneled $250 million into crisis pregnancy centers, adoption agencies, and maternity homes. More than a third of the nation's maternity homes have ties to Heartbeat International, which is, again, the world's largest anti-abortion organization. And Heartbeat says that its number of affiliated maternity homes have increased by 43% since the end of Roe. Many of these maternity homes in the United States are faith-based. And, you know, that can make things ethically murky. You know, if you have a counselor who believes in, you know, quote-unquote traditional family values and believes that adoption is a path to redemption, which, you know, some of their, you know, top executives at Heartbeat have openly said that. We play a clip of, one of them in the show saying that adoption is the greatest redemption ever. It can get very, very ethically murky. And it's unfortunate because I think maternity homes in theory would be good, right? You're a pregnant woman, you're in crisis, maybe you're in a domestic violence situation, the father is out of the picture in some other way, you don't have family support, maybe the safety net you had now suddenly disappears, you're making minimum wage, you don't get maternity leave, and you need help. And so theoretically, having a safe place for pregnant women to go is great. But I think that, you know, so many of these are run by conservative, you know, right-wing organizations, and that's where things get challenging. I think, you know, those of us on the left need to be thinking about how we can step in here. Like Planned Parenthood is a household name for, you know, abortion, STD testing, contraceptives, cancer screenings. But we have no household name equivalent on the left of if you're a pregnant woman and you need help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more of that in a second, but I just also wanted to circle back to something you brought up before, which is that there are 45 waiting families for every one adoptable infant. I'm assuming that that number keeps the gap between the number of people who want to adopt and the available babies to adopt is continuing to grow. Are maternity homes actually increasing the number of adoptable infants, or is that number continuing to go down every year?
Yeah, so the data on adoption is hard. It's a black box because we have no national regulatory system in place that requires reporting. It's really only when agencies, you know, voluntarily share this information. I do know that up to 80% of infant adoptions in the United States are through faith-based adoption agencies. So, you know, there is a huge number of, this sort of, again, traditional family value system driving this. I think we have to look at the whole picture. Crisis pregnancy centers are working in tandem with places like maternity homes and places like faith-based adoption agencies. You know, in our final episode, I spoke to one woman, Katie Burns. She didn't go through a maternity home. She went to a crisis pregnancy center, and the woman at the center would only talk to her about adoption and funneled her to a faith-based adoption agency. So, as it relates to the number of infants available, I mean, now that we have the end of Roe, experts that I've interviewed said that, you know, anytime you restrict, a choice, you're going to potentially get more adoptions. And I think what's happening now is we're also seeing, you know, these vital social services being cut by the Trump administration. Like Medicaid covers 40% of births. We're seeing a cut to, you know, food assistance. We're seeing cuts to affordable housing vouchers. And all of these things can create a perfect storm for a low-income woman who is pregnant, feels like she has no other option. And I think, yeah, you know, that's what can lead somebody to consider adoption. So unfortunately, I think as we see social services cut, as we see the right to end a pregnancy taken away and further restricted in states, that is something that can lead to more adoptions across the board.
So TJ, in the podcast in the final episode, you talk about how 9 out of 10 women considering adoption often do so for financial reasons, and that those financial reasons can be $1,000 or $2,000. It can be a rent payment. It can be, can I afford a stroller or a car seat? Can you talk about the organization SOS?
Yeah, so SOS stands for Saving Our Sisters, and they're a nonprofit grassroots organization, completely volunteer-led, and it's made up of a group of birth mothers. Renee Gellin is one of the co-founders, and Renee's story is really interesting in that she wasn't, you know, a teenager when she got pregnant. She was actually in her 40s when she got pregnant, and her business was going under. She already had one kid at home. Her health insurance said that they would not cover her delivery at the time, and she was in crisis. She panicked. She got pregnant through, you know, a boyfriend, but it was a new relationship. They had kind of just, you know, started dating for a few months. She did not know what to do. She said, you know, I was barely hanging on as my business went under, you know, to my house, and like, how am I going to do this with a new baby? And so she reached for the wrong help. I mean, she reached out, I guess I have to, you know, place this baby for adoption. And yeah, she wound up placing her son, and her adoption has since closed. But after that experience, Renee decided to start this organization, Saving Our Sisters. And yeah, they will pay, you know, maybe $5,000 to help a mom in need. And I think, you know, I want to be clear too, like, obviously $5,000 is not enough to raise a child to 18, but it's enough to convince someone that they feel like they have a choice to parent in the here and now. Because, you know, some people are just like, I don't know where I'm going to live with this newborn baby. I don't, you know, want to do this to this child. And so, like, having money to, get through a couple months rent while you figure things out, makes all the difference. And they also have something that we didn't get to cover in the podcast, but I find incredible, is a program called Sisters on the Ground. And so they have volunteers in every single state. And if an expectant mom or a recently postpartum mom is in crisis and feels like she might lose her child to adoption again because of lack of support, because of financial issues, they will actually deploy somebody in person to advocate for this woman on their behalf. And if they have signed the papers and they're still within that revocation period where they can change their mind, they'll help coordinate that. And so this organization, I just find them incredible. You know, they're all women who have gone through this and just want to help others not have to, you know, I think they say, make a permanent decision based on temporary circumstances. And
Yeah, I mean, and I also like, I think that there are situations probably where someone just doesn't want a parent, but they also don't want to have an abortion. And adoption is a good decision for them, even though it may be difficult because of the like bond between mother and baby. They want to do it. It's not like I don't have enough money. It's like I straight up don't want to raise this kid, but I don't want to not have it. Like that, in that circumstance, it seems like that's it's a great option, you know? And there are people out there that want to have a baby. And, you know, there's lots of people out there. But like, I feel like the number of those people compared to the number of adoptions is pretty small. And I kept thinking as I was listening to the podcast, like if adoption were treated like organ donation and made it so that it was not like essentially buying a baby, like if it were illegal for any entity to profit from the adoption of infants and like adoption was restricted to extended family or under all but the most extreme circumstances, like do you think maternity homes would exist? Like if all they were able to do was to give a place to live for like a pregnant person, do you think they would exist if there wasn't like an adoption component to make money off of?
I mean, I think some of them, you know, would definitely exist. But yeah, I mean, there are incentives here in places like, you know, I think in the UK and Australia and Germany, adoptions are completely managed by the state. Like there are not private entities where you have, you know, fees being exchanged for services and things like that. And those countries also, as you were saying, Erin, prioritize placing a child with an immediate family member. And if there's nobody available, then like placing that child in like a foster care system and doing, you know, an outside of family adoption. I think that there definitely are women who, you know, maybe don't believe in, you know, abortion or find out too late and feel like I can't be a parent. I want to do this adoption. You know, but as you said, those are very rare cases. Most people who, there's a study called the Turnaway Study, and it looked at women who were denied abortions and then what the outcome was. I think only, you know, like 5% of those women actually chose adoption in the end. The other 95%, they just chose to keep and parent their children after they were denied abortions. And so it's always the least popular choice among anyone who becomes pregnant. It's just not really appealing to most people, to the idea of, you know, gestating a full pregnancy, giving birth to that child, and then, separating from them. I mean, we hear from a woman in the show, Sarah P., and, you know, she actively chose this, but she said, you know, your body's different after that. Like, you know, you are conscious that there's a piece of you out there in the world. And even though she has a great relationship with her son's parents, they're still in touch. You know, she really is like kind of an extension of their family in a way. She's like, it's still hard. It's still painful. So it's, even if it's something you actively choose, I think that's also something that needs to be more discussed, is that for birth mothers. But I think the profit motive at, you know, private adoption agencies, they don't want to highlight all of the, you know, potential trauma or grief that you might experience 10 years down the line or 15 years down the line, because that could turn someone off from adoption. But I think it's a hard choice to make, even when it's one you actually really want.
So what are you hoping for once this podcast is, or now that the podcast is out there, like where can listeners find it?
Yeah, so Liberty Lost is available anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, you name it. We have 4 episodes out now for free. The final 2 episodes will also be released for free. Episode 5 will come out next Monday, and then the following Monday, episode 6 and a bonus episode. But if you want to binge the whole thing right now, you know, listeners can sign up for Wondery Plus. It's like $5 a month, and they can get everything right now ad-free and binge the whole thing. But I hope people, when they listen to this, just think more deeply about choice and what it means to choose and how we're, you know, supporting women or not supporting women. You know, I'm a firm believer in whatever you want to do if you're pregnant. If you want to end that pregnancy, you should be able to do that. If you want to parent that child, you should be able to do that. If you want to place that child for adoption, you should be able to do that. And I hope that this makes people think more deeply about that and how we can hopefully one day move towards a society where we have those options for real for everyone.
Wise words. Your lips to God's ears, TJ. Thank you so much for this podcast, and thank you for joining us this week. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sani Petty.
Hysteria is brought to you by Ritual. You know, Erin, sometimes I just can't get all my vegetables. Sometimes I don't want to eat my vegetables. Sometimes I've had a bad day, and sometimes I just want to have M&Ms.
M&Ms, a hamburger, chicken nuggets, chicken tenders, whatever. I can't
be in control all day, every day.
No.
Sometimes I just have to do what feels good instead of what's right, which is why I am grateful for Ritual's Essential for Women 18 and Over. Erin, I am most definitely over 18. The 18 and Over multivitamin isn't exactly a salad and a pill, but it is formulated to help you fill key nutrient gaps that you might not be getting enough from your diet.
I really like Ritual because I don't like taking pills. I know, controversial opinion. I don't love taking pills. And this is a multivitamin that covers all the bases I need it to cover. And it does so without giving me like a yucky multivitamin aftertaste. There's like a little minty fresh in the bottle. And so I just take it, go about my day, spend half of my time in the snack closet at work eating like bags of trail mix and beef jerky sticks. And I know that I'm not as depleted in vitamins and minerals if I would have been and not taken my Ritual. Here's how I know Ritual does what it's supposed to do, and I don't have to think about it. Ritual conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 and Over multivitamin to assess its efficacy. The results, it increased vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks.
Which was great for me because I have very low vitamin D levels. So I've been taking my Ritual, trying to get that vitamin D back up where it needs to be. Because, Erin, their Essential for Women 18 and Over contains 9 key nutrients in 2 delayed-release capsules designed for optimal absorption per day. Gentle on the stomach, minty essence like you mentioned, and Ritual's Essential third-party tested for heavy metals and Clean Label Project certified, so you know you can trust what you're putting in your body. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. Get 25% off your first month only at ritual.com/hysteria. Start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 and Over to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/hysteria for 25% off.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who hear the phrase princess treatment and think about how literal princesses were treated historically, i.e. being forced to marry their cousins and banished to the Tower of London if they failed to produce a male heir. But I don't think that's what they mean nowadays. Wait, Alyssa, have you been like following this princess treatment thing?
Lightly.
Okay. Yeah. There's like this lady on TikTok who talks about how she's treated like a princess. And by treated like a princess, she means like doesn't speak to the hostess or order her own food at a restaurant. It's like very, very weird. And if you're not, you know, following along, which if you're not, bless you. If you're not following along, a lot of people have pointed out that that's like fetish content. That is like, that's not princess treatment. That is fetish content. Let's move along before we get to Sandy Petty. We have some announcements for the class. Okay. Summer Reading Alert, Amanda Littman's new book, When We're in Charge, is out now from Crooked Reads. It's a guidebook to leadership for the next generation from the founder of Run for Something and the newest release from Crooked's publishing imprint.
When We're in Charge makes a great gift for new grads, friends celebrating a big promotion, or anyone looking to up their beach reading game this summer. Plus, you can complete your book look with a We Do Not Dream of Labor tote, perfect for anyone who wishes every day was a summer Friday. Just head to crooked.com/store for the exclusive tote bundle, or head straight to crooked.com/books to get the book.
I love that tote. It's a really sturdy tote. Good size.
I have to look at it. Book look was a tongue twister for me.
No, I love the tote. It's like my new A-team shopping bag for when I go to the store. All right. Republicans in Congress just passed one of the cruelest and least popular pieces of legislation in history, aka the reason why I was depressed on the 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
One of many reasons. It's going to kick millions of people off their health care so that rich people can get even richer. Many House Republicans who voted in favor of this bill won by slim margins and are facing tough re-elections next year.
We can hold them accountable by voting them out and taking back the House. That's why Vote Save America set up a Take Back the House fund to support must-win House races. To get more information, head to votesaveamerica.com/house. Paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. This ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
All right, now let's get to Sandy Petty. Alyssa, what do you got for us?
I'm feeling sane.
What?
I'm not feeling. I'm going to tell you the one thing that's making me feel sane.
You're the only one.
It's life in its purest form. This week, Aaron, it's not the same week every week, but this week in upstate New York, the fruit is aplenty, including my royalty raspberries. And one of my favorite things is that my friend from high school, Krista Greco, her daughter, Nat, runs one of the farm stands I go to, and she texted me before the show, and she's like, Alyssa, we got your raspberries. And so my favorite thing now is as soon as we're done here, I got to get down to Montgomery Orchards and pick up my flat. Aaron, you know some of this is coming your way because it's the most special jam you will ever have tasted. They were very special raspberries.
Yay.
And then I got a text from my old friend Nancy Eager down at Eager. She's like, we got apricots. And there's nothing nicer than just, it's always ladies. I have like 4 or 5 ladies around the county who know the fruit I like, and they just send me little texts like, we got currants. And in a world that's like so dark where it seems like nobody's doing anything nice, texts about raspberries and currants is so special.
That is pretty special.
Yeah, that's my Sandy.
All right, I'm feeling petty. I'm feeling petty.
Okay.
I'm watching Love Island USA.
All like right, I had a feeling.
A lot of people. Well, here's the thing. The reason it makes it very easy to become petty because there's so much of it. There's mm-hmm. It's like 6 hours a week. It's like a part-time, it's like a shift at a part-time job. You know what I mean? Like there's so much content. I barely have any time to do anything. So I'm like watching it in bed before I go to sleep on my phone just because I want to like catch up because if I go on TikTok before I'm caught up,
it'll be ruined.
It'll be ruined, right? And it's so, there's like so many things about it that I'm noticing. I'm noticing that like there's so much like nudity, like semi-nudity. There's not like actual nudity, but like so many like butts. There's so many butts.
So many
like under boobs and side boobs and top boobs and stuff. And like so many like abs and like what we used to call penis muscles. You know what I mean? Like lower abs. Like so much of that and so much like really like theatrical over the top, like making out by contestants during challenges and stuff. And it's like, it is not in any way titillating to me. It is like, I'm like desensitized.
I get it.
You know, like I would be more like, oh my God, if I was in public and I saw like one, like a couple and like one guy put his hand on the girl's butt in public over her clothes. Like that to me is more like sexy than what Love Island USA is. It's like it's very weird. I saw somebody being like, it's porn. And I'm like, no. Like it is desensitizing. I don't find it, like it's not sexy at all. But another thing that I've realized is that it is the reason that it's not that sexy or like that interesting, and there's only like one couple that seems like they really like each other, mm-hmm. is like it feels a little bit like watching a business meeting. Like these people speak to each other in like such business like a business like way. It's like they're all in HR. And
I was gonna say, is it therapy speak?
It's like therapy meets HR. So like they'll have like a conversation where someone would be like, you know, it made me uncomfortable during the last challenge when you licked Huda's belly button. And I just wanted to tell you that made me feel insecure and uncomfortable. And then the person would say like, well, I hear that you're insecure and uncomfortable, and I'm sorry that I did that to you. It was part of the challenge, and I got carried away. I wasn't considering your feelings, and then it's just, but it like,
Erin, no, I get it. It sounds like mediation,
right? It's like couples counseling with no counselor there,
right?
And like they're not really quite getting what the like actual. There's no actual feeling below right. what they're saying, or like the feeling below what they're saying is buried beneath all of this like subtext and like steps that they've been told they have to take in communication for it to be effective. It's like aliens having a business meeting. It's so weird. And I also think that it like a thing I'm feeling petty about is I think like younger Gen Z, not older Gen Z, people who are like 25 and older, you're off the hook. You're fine. You're not fine, but like you're better. But the ones that are younger, like the COVID generation,
yeah,
are completely inept. Like they don't, they are like, they're cooked. Like they like are, they're driven crazy by the fact that they're not, they don't have access to social media for the first time, maybe in their, you know, entire
lives
since they were teenagers. They don't have access to someone just telling them what they think of them. They can't just log in and be like, what do people think of me? What do I look like? What do people think of me? What do people think of me? They only like get drips and drabs of it, right? And so I think it's driving some of them crazy. I also think that they don't have the emotional faculties to like foster real connections. They can only like perform sexuality and not like it's like those I guess like on I see sometimes on social media where it's like aesthetic, you know, here's the like gothic academia aesthetic. It's like people want to like wear the aesthetic without like without anything supporting what begot the aesthetic. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's like
right.
This is why people dress this way. They want to like dress that way without doing any of the things that cause people to dress that way. I feel like it's that with sex. Like they want to be sexy without understanding what underlies sexiness.
Right.
Which is like attraction, which is like being excited about somebody, which often is like, it's very weird.
Erin, how many episodes of this are there?
There's like 32.
That's insane.
I have, I know that's so many hours.
For one season? For one season?
They're not even done yet. They have like two or three more episodes left. I'm like, it's so much time. I'm like embarrassed by how much time I've spent watching this show, but I've like started thinking about it like an anthropologist. Like, what is this? How is this a reflection? What is this doing to me as a viewer? And what does it mean about my place in the world? What is it doing to these contestants? What does it mean about the world that
what it means about you is that nothing good has come out in a couple weeks, okay? But tomorrow we get the new Lena Dunham show with Megan. Is her name Megan from Hacks?
Meg Stalter.
Comes out tomorrow. I feel like that is the palate cleanse that will be needed.
Oh, Lena, I never thought I would say this, but save me, Lena Dunham.
Lena, we're glad you're back, girl.
We're counting on you.
Hannah Horvath.
I'm sorry about all the things that I said about you being annoying in
2016. We were all growing, okay? You need you back.
You were annoying in 2016, but before that, you gave us so much that we should have given you
so
more
much.
Grace. We should have given you more grace.
Lena, come on Hysteria. Can we get Lena on Hysteria?
I don't think she's going to want
after she
I'm
will.
Like, you were annoying in 2016.
Yeah, but I'm sure. Listen, if you told me I was annoying in 2016, I'd be like, girl, I probably was.
Oh, I was extremely annoying in 2016. I was at the peak of my physical attractiveness and I had not been humbled yet. And it was like, I was the worst. I was at my worst, but also I had the best year of my life. It was so fun, but I was awful.
See? Right. Life ebbs and flows. And all I'm
saying
is—
best year of my life— until November.
Up
until November, it was like
up until November. The girls' rewatch has been enjoyable.
Yeah, it's a good thing. You know what? That is what I'm going to do. I'm going to palate cleanse with some girls.
Yes.
After this.
Early seasons.
I think in my defense, I know that like a lot of people are like, Love Island, it's so dumb. I know.
Well, right.
I know it's dumb. Like it is.
But you're invested.
It is a show that I watch because, first of all, a lot of people are watching it, so I feel like I'm participating in a monoculture that is like vanishing in this country. I feel like, oh, I'm doing something with other people. I'm not isolated with my children or like isolated in my little life in my little house, and like, you know, I'm doing something with other people that I can't see. We're all doing this at the same time. That's fun. It's like watching a sporting event, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I get that it's dumb, but I also think like given the overwhelming nature of news and the overwhelming darkness of the world that we're in right now, everybody needs a way to just like tap out for a little bit, right? Like tap out permanently, but like I can't constantly be thinking about the direction that things are going. I will exhaust myself and be completely unable to do anything. To make anything better.
But you know what I do?
What?
I put my phone away. I make myself a little cannabis cocktail right around 8 o'clock. I put my feet up. And I don't care what day it is. I rewatched the last two episodes of In Just Like That. Because you know what? Carrie's got shoes. She's got clothes. I think she needs a new man. I'm kind of bored of Aiden. But everything else, they're just like old friends who haven't changed that much, and that's delightful.
I think after And Just Like That, they should do like a ghost version where they all
meet
in the afterlife. They all meet in the afterlife.
Amazing. And it's like, and now Carrie's got a cat, so you know I'm invested in a whole different way.
I am worried about Shu. I feel like this whole
Shu's going to get out.
This whole season has been, you remember the season of Mad Men where we all thought that Meghan Draper was going to get murdered?
Yeah.
Because they kept referring to Sharon Tate.
Yes.
We were all like, she's going to get murdered. She's in LA. She's living in the Hollywood Hills. She's going to get murdered. I feel like that is Shu's role in this season of Just Like That.
Everything is just a little too, every time she picks Shu up, puts her out her door, you're like, where's Shu going to go? And that is part of the fun, but it's also Sex and the City, so we know Shu's not going to die. So it is an anxiety that we can actually live with.
Yeah, and I feel like we know one writer in that writer's room who is a cat person.
Yes.
Like she likes animals. So
and
I
may text her after every episode.
I feel like,
this is what I loved. What's going on?
Can you tell me about this? I don't think that my hope lies with Sam, our friend.
Yes.
And I think that I trust that Sam will not kill the cat. Please do
Sam
not.
Sam won't kill the cat. She knows.
All right. That's all the time we have for this week's episode of Hysteria. It was a heavy week, man.
Well, we brought it home.
We're really glad, listeners, that you're here with us. We love having you here. This is like, it's like we're all participating in this, right?
Yeah.
Like I talk about Love Island. We're sitting there doing, you're listening to this with other listeners all over the place. And you're all, you know, you're with us. We're with you. If you want to get in touch, hysteria@crooked.com. I want to thank Alyssa Mastromonaco, as always, for being my ride or die. And this probably got edited out. At least I hope it did. Bringing me back from tears during the recording of this episode. We're just real human beings. Hey, I can't be anything but a real human being. Also, nope. TJ Raphael, we would like to thank her for her amazing podcast.
Unbelievable.
Liberty Lost. If you haven't listened to it, listen to it immediately, but give yourself some space and time because you might need to take like rage walks between episodes.
Yes.
And I mean that in a good way. This is like stuff that you need to
There's a lot to consider.
A lot to consider. Stuff you need to know, and it's done so well. So thanks to TJ for joining us. And listeners, thanks again for joining us this week. There will be more Hysteria for you next week.
Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on IG.
Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusives like This Fucking Guy, our video series. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Claire Fogarty is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seguin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Claudia Sheng. And thank you to Daisy Cruz and David Tolles for production and marketing support every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.